A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 20, 1995, in the series The Human Story, Paradigms of Grace, entitled Jacob, Expletive Deleted. The scripture reading is Genesis 25, verses 19 through 29, and chapter 27, verses 1 through 10 and 30 through 41. The text for the sermon is Genesis 27, verse 38. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Manipulation and meanness and bitter fruit. That was last week's story, the story of Sarah and Hagar. And it's the human story. And in the face of the tragedy of the human situation, I raised the question, is there any hope? And made the modest suggestion that the hope lies in a person here or there who has a change of consciousness and sees another way of being, or maybe a community of people. And before the anguish and the tragedy of the human situation, that is admittedly a very modest suggestion. Particularly for us, are we not a people that wants a quick fix? Wouldn't we like to find the final solution? But it is not so. And the meanness and the bitter fruit continues to be harvested down through the generations. A couple weeks ago, as I mentioned last week at the conference, whose theme was encounter, where there was the encouragement to dialogue with others who were different. The suggestion was that through knowledge and insight comes transformation. But you know, it comes one person at a time and one small community at a time. And we can't all traverse the world, circle the globe, get all of that experience, but sometimes a story will do. And I found myself impacted again this week with the story of Esau and Jacob. It's a familiar old story, again, right at the heart of the old tradition that has shaped us. And you know the story. There's the birth, the conflicted birth. Well, maybe I should begin with the barrenness of Rebekah. Like father, like son, you know. Abraham chooses Sarah and her womb was barren, and Isaac chooses Rebekah and her womb was barren. I suppose the text is really trying to tell us, so that we don't miss the point, rubbing our nose in it, as it were, that this line of blessing will be God's doing and not a matter of human manipulation or cleverness. The promise bearers arise out of barren wombs. But now that she's pregnant, Rebecca says, I'd like to die. And God says, that's because there's two nations in your womb. And then the birth happens, and little Esau comes out all red and hairy. That's the kind of an infant you look at, and wanting to be positive with the parents, you say, that's a baby. And after him comes Isaac, grabbing onto his heel, which the story is trying to tell us is going to be symbolic of the life of these two. And then there's the birthright story. Esau, man of the field. But he's the firstborn. He's got it all coming to him by social convention. by conventional wisdom. He's the firstborn, so he's got it all coming to him. But slippery, wily Jacob catches him in a moment of vulnerability. He says, "Swear to me you'll give me your birthright." Esau says, "If I don't have a bowl of that soup, I'm going to die anyway. Of course you can have my birthright. Give me the stew." And then the sad tale at the end of Isaac's life, when he calls his favorite son Esau, says, "Go get me game, make me a meal. I want to give you the blessing before I die." Rebekah, hearing the story, pushes Jacob, and I don't think she had to push very hard. Terrible deceit. Jacob taking the blessing that belonged to Esau, and Esau coming in to find out that it was all over. As I went back over that story and thought about it, the words of chapter 27 and 38, verse 38, just really struck me. "Have you but one blessing, Father? Bless me, even me." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept bitterly. And I wept too for Esau, and I wept for myself. For all of the years that I have read that story and just taken it at face value, failing to feel Esau's pain and failing to recognize in Esau's question, the key question that has enough dynamite in it to blow up the whole tradition: "Just one blessing, Father?" As I thought about that story, I thought that's the kind of story that could be transforming if we would really open our minds and our hearts to it. Oh, I understand the tradition, and the tradition itself is wonderful. The tradition is trying to say that it is God who takes the initiative. It is God who is gracious. It is God who chooses, or that old theological word, who elects. And the consequence of that, the fact that it is all of God, is that I acknowledge my inability, and I acknowledge that it is not my righteousness or my virtue or my cleverness. It is all of God. I can rest in God. God's choice is my resting place. That's wonderful. And so that leads to humility. And humility leads to gratitude. I know what the tradition is trying to do. It's tracing that covenant line. But I have to admit that even as a child, I was bothered by election, the fact that God chooses some and not others. I sort of stuffed the question because, after all, it's all over the Bible. You can't start taking the scissors and, you know, cutting it out. But it always did bother me that some people were born destined for salvation and some people were born destined for damnation. I think probably a lot of us have shared that question if we've ever even thought about it. But then there was a point at which I came to understand that election in the Bible was not to salvation, but rather it was to service. God chose the few on behalf of the many. God chose a special people in order to bring light to all people. So those who were specially blessed were to be a blessing. That softened it for me. But I have to tell you, another time around, and I just want to say, even though I understand the positive side of that teaching, that biblical teaching of election, I want to say, coming down another time, we human beings can't handle it. Because it may lead us to humility. And it may lead us to gratitude. But it will inevitably lead us also to a sense of superiority. And I could weep for all the years I just took that story without questioning it. Without saying, not only what is the tradition trying to teach me here about God's grace and God's redemption, but what else is in that tradition? Who wrote it? Israel wrote it. How do you write your own story? Well, I'll say, to their credit, they put a lot of candor in their story. I mean, your forefather and foremother being weak Abraham and mean Sarah and deceitful Rebekah and wily Jacob, those aren't moral heroes. The biblical story isn't about moral heroes. And to Israel's credit, they acknowledged the flawedness of those who were at the origin of their tradition. But nevertheless, and this is something that we ought to face honestly and come to terms with, every religious tradition has a political agenda. And when Israel is telling this story, it is telling this story about God and God's grace and God's choice of them for a special vocation, but it is also saying, humble as we are still chosen by God to be the bearers of light to the world. And you can see the political agenda if you recognize in the Hebrew text. Hebrew language has letters for consonants. And then the vowels are little points over or under or between the consonants. So the same consonants can be used for several different words depending on how you point the vowels. And the vowels DM, or the consonants DM, are the consonants of that word red, when the text says that Esau came out of the womb red. Adum. And when old Jacob was stirring up his pottage, the word was adum, red. It was some kind of red stew. And those same consonants, DM, are the consonants of Edom, the people, the Edomites. And the tradition written by Israel was saying, humble as we are nonetheless superior. We are God's chosen people in relationship to all of these surrounding nations, especially the Edomites. The Edomites embodied in Esau were destined for pottage, and we destined for glory. You see, that's my point. I took that whole matter of God choosing and the biblical doctrine of election at face value for so long that I never questioned it sufficiently, and as I come back to question it, at this advanced stage in my senility, I gotta say, human beings can't handle that kind of biblical teaching because it creates inevitably a kind of superiority. It somehow or other has a kind of chemical reaction within the human being that says, not only do I have the truth, but I have all the truth. My family, my tribe, my nation, my religion, It is as human as motherhood and apple pie is American. It's not a Jewish problem. When the Christian movement claimed to supersede Judaism, it claimed that it was in the driver's seat now, the elect of God. And when Islam came along 6 centuries later, it claimed to supersede both Judaism and Christianity. There is something about human beings and religion that makes us want to have it all. A corner on the truth, the bearer, exclusive bearer of the light, the people who are in over against the people who are out. And that has wreaked so much damage and so much havoc down through the centuries that I cannot believe that we in the religious institution have not faced it more squarely and more honestly. I cannot believe that we in the church have waited for people on the outside to throw the light on that rather than us within, critiquing our own tradition and recognizing what happens when we are moved to exclusivity, when we are moved to that superiority that claims that we have the light and all of the light, that we have the truth and all of the truth, that it is somehow incumbent upon us to save the rest of the world, recognizing not at all that we are a part of a human family, that all alike stand before the absolute and holy God with very partial apprehension and very limited insight and understanding. This is not an ancient story. This is about our world today. Last month in the Chicago Tribune, there was a fine article on a situation in Israel that is current. The Union of Rabbis for the Land of Israel, a very conservative fundamentalist group of rabbis, issued an edict, unprecedented in Israel, in which they forbade soldiers to dismantle their camps or the settlements in the West Bank. Now the Rabin government is trying to negotiate that peace process with the Palestinians. It is torturous. It is fraught with all kinds of difficulty. There are those on both sides that don't want it to happen. And now as it seems to be moving a little closer, these rabbis, a large segment, a significant segment, issued an edict that said the soldiers are forbidden by religious authority to fulfill the command of the government authority. And it could lead to a civil war within Israel itself. And one of the modern heroes of the world today, I believe, is a David Hartman, whose son was here a couple of months ago. David Hartman, an Orthodox rabbi in Jerusalem, who has the Shalom Hartman Institute to try to aid and abet the peace proposition, has spoken out against the edict, and he has identified where the problem is. It looks like a political problem, but it is a religious problem. These conservative rabbis are saying, God gave this land to the Jews. And until the Jews are in this land exclusively, Messiah will not come. And they have no argument with peace with Egypt. They have no argument with peace with Syria. But they will not tolerate peace with the Palestinians, granting that the Palestinians are home in Israel as well as they themselves. It is a religious conviction. It is a literal reading of the text. And David Hartman says, it is that kind of biblical literalism that is fueling the possibility of world conflagration. Now that happens to be just something that's happening right now. But as Hartman said shortly after that peace process in an article that he wrote, one must bear in mind that the biblical framework is not particularly conducive to the resolving of territorial or cultural conflicts. The parting of the ways of the chosen and the rejected sons is a central theme of biblical history, beginning in Genesis and continuing through the biblical narrative. There is always one person who receives a blessing and one who is rejected. Ishmael is expelled. Isaac is chosen. Jacob acquires Esau's birthright, and there's nothing for Esau. And he goes on quoting the text of last week, and then quoting the text of today, and then pleading with his own people to acknowledge that it is their biblical tradition that is blocking the possibility of human peace. In another interview with the Voice of America, he said the biblical story throughout informed by the principle that only one child inherits, the theme of the chosen versus the rejected recurs repeatedly throughout the Bible. One son gets the blessing, the other gets none. And then he says, I believe that our role as Jews today is to change this aspect of the story. We began the story, and now we have to come back and say our story has another part to it. God listens to many different songs and melodies. In Israel, when last year Baruch Goldstein, born in this country but immigrating to Jerusalem, to Palestine, went into the mosque temple in Hebron. Now get this, friends. What is the shrine? Where did the massacre happen? It happened at the shrine of Abraham. The shrine of Abraham, in which Jews and Muslims pray at different ends of the building. This Jewish man, with all of his fanaticism, he does it for God, you see. He does it because the Bible says, you see. He goes in and he machine guns people at prayer. And Rabin says, that grew up on a foreign shore in an alien swamp. Rabin, the prime minister, he says, that's not Israel. That's not Jewish. And David Hartman, the Jewish rabbi, says, that is Jewish. It is in the system. It is in the tradition. It is time we honestly say it's in the tradition and change the story. Let's argue with the tradition. Let's recognize where the tradition has led astray. Let's recognize that you cannot simply reiterate that which evolved 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, and make it some kind of literal application to the world today. There is a living tradition. There is an ongoing community of faith. Esau's question is the question of the hour. My father, is there but one blessing? Down through the centuries, institutionalized religion, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, has said yes, just one blessing. It's time for us to answer Esau and say, no, Esau, there is not just one blessing. There was another Jew, and he came daring to challenge the tradition. His collected teachings have appearing several times the word, it has been said, but I say unto you. It is time that the followers of Jesus have the courage to say, it has been said, but in the light of all that we know, in light of all that we know of the way of Jesus and the God embodied in Jesus and the human experience down through the centuries, in light of all that we know, it has been said, but we must say. He told the story of a father who had two sons, and one was wild and woolly, and one was tame and boring. And when the wild one came home, the father greeted him with tears of joy and threw a party. And when the boring one came from the field, he said to him, you come in too. Because I have not just one blessing. And it is the farthest thing from my mind that I should choose one son and reject another. All of you, come into the party and let's dance.